Welcome everybody to this exclusive nightclub only podcast where my guest today is Michelle Lowe. We engage in a deep exploration of yoga nidra or yoga sleep from a yogini's point of view, and we discover its many multi-layered applications to physical, psychological, and spiritual well-being. How exactly does yoga nidra relate to the koshas or the sheaths? And where does it transition from entry-level bandwidths associated with liminal dreaming all the way to luminosity yoga in the Tibetan tradition? Michelle shares a number of really powerful personal stories revealing the transformative effects, healing effects for her of yoga nidra in her own life. The conversation then turns to how to actually get into this practice, including a conversation about the 61 points of light and the rotation of consciousness practice. Where do all the healing benefits come from and why can they occur so quickly and irrevocably? Michelle then talks about the importance of spiritually guided intention and why we need to be free of doubt. From releasing stress and tension all the way to exploring the clear light mind, yoga nidra expands all the nocturnal meditations. In the Hindu tradition, yoga nidra actually denotes the highest state of consciousness, as well as the state of Vishnu at the end of this world age or yuga. This is what makes this ancient practice so unique. From grade school all the way to grad school, yoga nidra is a type of physical, psychological, and spiritual ATV, or all states of consciousness practice, that anyone can readily engage and benefit from. Hey, welcome everybody to the Center of Mind podcast. Andrew Holacek here. It's my complete, real, genuine delight to introduce you to a dear friend of mine, Michelle Lowe, who's, as you'll see, just a remarkable individual. We had fantastic opportunity to hang out quite a bit this summer at the wonderful Menla Retreat Center in upstate New York. I got to know her and her work even more intimately, and I'm super excited to share her light with our community. And so, as usual, a very brief introduction, and we're just going to jump right in. So Michelle Lowe is an international yoga teacher and practitioner of Hatha and Tibetan yogas, and the founding director of the Vajra Yoga School of Comparative Buddhist and Indic Yogic Studies that she co-teaches with our mutual friend, Professor Robert Thurman. She has taught, practiced, and studied avidly since 1998 and continues to run her longtime yoga studio in Portland. She's also on the board of Tibet House USA and is devoted to supporting His Holiness the Dalai Lama's mission, as well as preserving Tibetan culture and Dharma. And then the rest of her really rich bio, along with associative links and whatnot, we'll post as usual on the site. But for now, Michelle, a deep, warm welcome to our community, and a bow of gratitude in advance for taking the time out of your really busy schedule to chat with us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Andrew. I'm a huge fan of yours, and so are many of the students that, of course, you know, because of your relationship with Bob and Tibet House and Menla, there's so many people that I know that are devoted to you.
And oh, it's fun.
It's really great to be here.
That's a delight.
I wish I had more time to take all of your courses.
Oh, yeah, likewise.
My bucket list to go through all of Andrew's offerings.
Yeah, same with you and what you're doing with Bob. Yeah. It's just amazing. But I want to start, Michelle. You have one of the richest histories and the set of experiences around a topic that I think is a bit misunderstood in the West, and that I talk about within a particular context, which I will share with you. But I really want to hear and use as our kind of seed question for our conversation together, this rich arena of study and practice called yoga nidra. And so if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about how you got into yoga nidra, how it's benefited you, what is it exactly, and where does it, you know, stand in your life today? So lots of initial questions across the brow here, but this is such a rich arena that my community is super interested in.
Well, I love yoga nidra and I love talking about it. So thank you for the question. So I started practicing yoga nidra pretty much at the beginning of my yoga career. So I'd say 1998. And then I got, I was very blessed to have at the first studio that I was teaching at and practicing in 2000, a teacher that had was very close to Richard Miller, mm-hmm. who has developed a system of yoga nidra called iRest. Mm-hmm. And Richard Miller taught my colleague Simon Menashe. And so that was the first system that I learned. And I practiced that for a long time. 20 some years. And then it wasn't until after. Oh, okay. So then I'll back up. So when I was practicing iRest, I had a very restful practice, healing practice, effects on my body and mind. And I felt it was just a really good adjunct to relaxing and feeling free of stress and working with the rest of my yoga practice. It really helped me to learn to let go, to surrender and just really be deeply present. And it also helped me to work with that, the witness consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, we would say purusha, right? In Sanskrit, the seer, that one that sees. So for me, it was a bit more of a sort of a dualistic practice at that time of kind of being connected to my body, dissolving things that were creating pain in the physical body, kind of going through all of the sheaths, the layers of the body, or in classical yoga, we'd call them the koshas, right? And so that working with the mind and the physical body and the mental body, of course, and emotions, and then the bliss body. And I had delighted in those practices, but then it was really I guess it was in 2012 that I first was exposed to more of the Sri Vidya Tantra. And I was practicing a lot of Sri Vidya Tantra and working with people that had connected to the Himalayan master teaching teachers. And with that and sort of the Nyasa practice that we were doing and just more time to move into the heart and meditate and rest there, I started to have sort of deep, we never like to say samadhi, but it was definitely a single point awareness, bliss, more of a clarity of mind, a connecting to original mind. Maybe we could say Mahamudra type of experience. You know, it's hard to put a name to it. It's Turiya, the four state, but it was it was a very different type of experience. And then when I did in 2014 my first Abhishekam with His Holiness the Dalai Lama in Ladakh, India, in Kalachakra, and I started to deeply study with Bob. I was very fortunate that to have Bob Thurman there with me. So the empowerment counted because he told us what was going to happen before we went in to the grounds to hear His Holiness. And then he explained what happened right after. So we were having an understanding and at the same time receiving the teachings. And the similarities between what was happening there. In fact, I had really quite profound dreams, you know, the day before the initiation. All of my Kalachakra Abhishekams have had very powerful dreams right before, which are, yeah, if we have time, I'll tell you about them. But anyway, so that's when that and the Sri Vidya type, the Nyasa type that I was really practicing started to connect the dots and kind of Vajrayana helped me then to see what was happening in my personal practice of yoga nidra was maybe not too much different. And now I've jumped to, after having studied, you know, as much as I can with people like you, and reading your books, of course, mm-hmm. and it's really, to me, they're not that much different. Mm-hmm. So it's an entryway. It's been an entryway for sure to working with the practice of sleep and dream yogas and the night yogas, and even some of the clear light sleep, which is what I like to call the yoga nidras that I do, clear light yoga nidra. And anyway, yeah. So that's
that's fantastic. It's really rich. And so most people listening will know what we're talking about here when we talk about yoga nidra, but nidra is Sanskrit for sleep, right? So it's basically where you talk about sleep yoga. But it's interesting, right? And correct me if I'm wrong, Michelle, it's a little bit different from the classic Ursal luminosity yoga, sleep yoga, and for instance, the six yogas of Naropa, right? So can you talk to us, before we go to that deeper end of the pool, because obviously that's where you have just tremendous expertise and experience. Maybe talk to us a little bit about your entry experiences with yoga nidra as liminal state experiences, because often when I'm sharing what yoga nidra is, at least at entry levels, I equate it more with like liminal dreaming, the exploration of hypnagogic spaces. So talk to us a little bit about that kind of entry level approach to yoga nidra before we go to the real deep end of the clear light.
Right. So, well, most of the yoga nidra, if you just like go onto YouTube and you connect to yoga nidra, relaxation practices they're really going to be liminal practice. So I would say 99% of it is. And then, for me, that was really it's a quite powerful practice because I used that at the point that I had a brain injury in 2019. And I couldn't really sleep. I was often just in that place because I couldn't go, really any deeper. So that was how I would get rest. And then that started to move to when I started to get better at that and also starting to work with dream yoga practice more. Always in the morning when I would wake up, I would go back in, especially if I wanted to kind of stay in the liminal state, I would just go back into yoga nidra and then try to catch the dream back again. So I would stay there. I just learned to work with, if I was coming out, I'd go back in and use some of my techniques in yoga nidra and pop back into liminal and then see if I could, re-catch everything. So, yeah. So that's the difference is the time. Mm-hmm. The time length that you're there, because if you do a yoga nidra practice online and it's about, usually they're about sometimes 20 minutes, even quite short, 20, 30 minutes, that's all you're going to be in is liminal. And that's just because of the brain waves. You really need to be 45 minutes to catch that delta. And then have the possibility of the delta waves to be that slow that you can go into more of the to the sleep state. Mm-hmm. And so the other thing is where you rest your mind, because depending on how they do the yoga nidra, for instance, Richard Miller works a lot with opposing patterns. So you're forced, like if he's working on the physical body, you would be feeling, say a common one is, to feel the quality of heaviness in the body. And then you focus on that for a while. And then you would shift to focusing on lightness and that, and then you would bring the two together. And that witness consciousness would then be able to see in the pouring together of opposing patterns, the witness consciousness would reflect, it kind of reflects in that pause, that inability to hold, or the ability to hold opposing patterns, right? It just comes back. I've just lost my train of thought. So we're back to.
Well, I think one way we could talk about this, let me just ping this.
Or ask me the question again. Yeah.
Yeah. No. It's basically the relationship of entry level yoga nidra as liminal dreaming, eventually taking you all the way to the deep end of the pool with clear light. And so let me just ping something here that may be a benefit is that the more I explore this practice of yoga nidra, it's kind of a multivalent practice, which means it has a number of different iterations, expressions, and then engagements. We can use it in so many different ways, each one of which has its own applicability, bandwidth, and value. And so I think that's also very helpful because...
So that's where I was going. Yeah. Because so it's like with Richard's style, he's working with the opposing patterns. You're going back and forth and then it's really of a witness consciousness and it's connected to these various sheaths of the body. When you're working with like a Nyasa practice, you're going around and you're placing, whether it's points of light or you're working with mantra, you're placing those in various parts of the body. 61 points is classical. You can have, rotation of awareness. And then there's different, depending on the type, I use all of them, but there's also types of yoga nidra that gets you to go through rotation of consciousness and then place visuals in. And I like to utilize those as entryway to work it with dream yoga practice. Mm. But so all of those keep you in that sort of liminal state. Mm-hmm. But then when you want to go deeper, you have to be able to at some point and be there long enough to where the body gets relaxed and actually invite it to go into a sleep state. So most of them keep you liminal by continuing to talk you through. So there's the person helping you, the guide helping you, or, of course I practice yoga nidra on my own, so you don't need that, but a guide to do it. But if you have a certain setup, rotation of consciousness, relax the body, get the body completely relaxed. And then where it moves beyond the liminal is when you can go into the heart. And, or you could do throat if you wanted to, but for me, my focus is on the heart. And then you just practice within silence. And that it takes at least, it's usually about 10 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes of total silence and meditation where you start to access that state of sleep in the heart and rest awareness in the state of sleep. And sometimes for me, that's where I will, focus on the blue light in the heart, mm-hmm. the mantra, and just go to sleep in my heart. Mm-hmm. And that's where you can start to notice, of course, you can catch it through 8 stages of dissolution that will even pop up there and catch clear light sleep. So, but you have to be, it could be that you're resting there for an hour before it happens, 90 minutes, 2 hours, so I accessed that after my brain injury because I couldn't sleep for 3 hours or 4 hours. So, it was that waking constantly. And then, but I wanted to be able to put my body to sleep. So I used yoga nidra as a way to put myself to sleep. And that's when I found that you could actually, it was not so different than having, it was beyond liminal. It was indescribable, but you could be there and in bliss and be asleep.
So this is fantastic. Say a little bit more, if you would, when you're talking about doing the rotation of consciousness, the rotation of awareness, and then what makes it kind of a transition into dream yoga or even sleep yoga, you use the phrase you place visuals. And so I want you to elaborate on that. I would suspect you're talking about then concentrating either on the throat for dream yoga or the heart.
That's right.
For sleep yoga. And so can you say a little bit more about the mantra that's associated with that and how you
actually... Sure. Then, so
that?
For instance, you could go into the throat and you could actually see the petals and the Anuttara, Om mm-hmm. Anuttara. You could actually see a seed syllable and just meditate there. So once the body is relaxed, then, and I do these all the time, I actually expanded my yoga nidra practices to when I'm working with students on a familiarization retreat, then again with visuals, I actually, because Bob and I teach Kala Chakra retreat, familiarization retreats. So on those retreats, students have when they're especially entry level, they're still having a hard time, thinking about what Kala Chakra is holding in their 24 arms and, all of their, Vajra Bell, Sword and Shield, Katvanga and Trident, tipped Katvanga all the way up. So I started doing these these yoga nidras where I would put people out into, you know, by going through rotation of consciousness, getting the body very relaxed. And then, and this is liminal too, of course, this practice is liminal. And then talking them through the mandala and even entering the doors. And then now you're Kala Chakra and you have this, and they come out of it remembering everything that they were holding. And so it's a fast way, as you know, from reading about yoga nidra, from what it does for memory and the benefits for liminal type, you can use visuals like that. But then if you're using it for as a way to go kind of beyond into sleep and dream, that's where get the body so relaxed and then just meditate on that lotus, that seed syllable, and then in silence in that meditation, go into your sleep or dream yoga practice. So you're it's actually counter to what most people do with yoga nidra, which is not fall asleep.
Right? Yeah.
But we're trying to do so, and for me it works, but maybe I'm off my rock.
No, hardly. I mean, really, in my languaging, Michelle, this would be also termed, again, in a little bit deeper kind of intermediate relationship to yoga nidra is lucid sleep onset. In other words, you're basically, you know, as you know, there's two ways to bring about lucidity. Let's just say dreams. There's two ways to bring it about. We can either initiate lucidity within the dream. That's called a dream initiated lucid dream, or you can bring it with you. That's called awake initiated lucid dream. And so this is more greasing the skids for that more advanced way to basically maintain a thread of awareness consciousness through the witnessing stance. And basically bringing, tucking that awareness into your mind as you go to sleep. So that when you enter the dream arena, then of course it's lucid. You're bringing your awareness into that. Does that resonate with your experience?
That does. That very much does resonate. It's exactly it.
Perfect. So let's backpedal for just a second, because some of our listeners may not be that familiar with like the context, the history of yoga nidra, its relationship, you know, like Buddhist Hindu approaches. Like, do you have a sense of?
Yeah, you know, I don't have. I'm not the best person on the history of it in regards to that. I think I would say 10th, 11th century Mahasiddhas is really, you know, that time, both with the Mahasiddhas, both the Indian masters and Tibetan masters as well, that moving into practice together. So I think it's around that time. And from this point, is definitely the Nyasa practice is at least, it's even older than that. So I would, you know, my feeling is that they've been doing it for a long time because when you're practicing, right, we're in dark retreat, we're on retreat, we're practicing, and then you spend time lying down. And you know, I think that we've been doing this in this way, formal way, placing mantra and visualizing the mantra in going to sleep and dream like this since, you know, probably much before we get, six yogas of Naropa and Niguma, and that Mahasiddha period, there's those sleep and dream yogas. I'm sure that you had the other Himalayan masters doing the same thing, but they just called it different. So it's yoga nidra.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know, you know, but the history way back, that's not my thing so much.
That's totally fine. So do you find yourself drawing more on Hindu expositions of this practice? Because it's not that overtly articulated. Let me phrase this another way then. So where do you find your kind of textual and historical
frameworks? I just see that's, I'm a practitioner, I'm a yogini, so I'm finding it from memory and from intuitive knowledge. So that's why I can say, you know, I'm really not the one to go back into history and do all of the research on time and dates and who figured it out and all of that. It's just more about remembering.
Beautiful.
And knowing that this is how, I'm trying to figure out what my connection with the Tibetans is, because certainly, I came into doing 25 years of Hatha yoga, and then I met Bob Thurman, and then it's just one after another. So I'm going to be teaching with a co-retreat with Kalo Rinpoche on Lady Nagumo yoga at Menla.
Oh, fantastic.
And and the beginning of April, and I'm friends with Ling Rinpoche now, and I had audience at this holiness this year. That's just very strange. I don't know what's going on with all of it.
But, I wouldn't say it's strange. I think that's pretty beautiful.
It's very beautiful, and they do visit, and there's it's very easeful for me to lay my head in the guru's lap and go to sleep.
Yeah.
Very useful. Like, so it's remembering. I think we did it before, and that's where I'm getting it. I have to say, I'm kind of making it up as I go along, but it's not from out of nowhere. It's from, from an intuitive knowing. And so practice, you have to practice it a lot. You don't just, you have to do it. So that's the other thing, is I've been practicing them, working with them, and from that, sharing it.
And so this is really nice, because, the Vajrayana once famously said the essence of spiritual practice is remembrance. And that applies on so many different levels. And so the fact that you're actually calling on the inner lineage, the guru within, you're drawing on that own innate wisdom on one level, makes it a really direct lineage transmission and more impactful. And so for people, let's talk about this briefly. So for people that are relatively new to this, before we go off the, or really take the deep dive, for someone who's interested in learning about yoga nidra classically, what might you recommend for a beginner who really wants to explore this kind of liminal practice from a yoga nidra point of view? What's the best way for someone to come into this sphere of practice?
Take my course that starts tomorrow night.
Perfect.
And
if
they can't come to that, we're going to do 3 5-days. And so it's 100 hours, and it's all, on the Teachable platform. But,
fantastic.
But right. So what I do is I introduce all of the different types. And so we look at the classical way, right? The classical way would be to work with the koshas, the layer of the body, layers, various sheaths of the body. And so this way of working will, your physical body, your mental, your pranic body, your mental body, your intuitive body, and the anandamaya kosha, the bliss body. Mm-hmm. And all of those are considered to be illusory, right? The maya koshas. So yoga nidra, working on each one of those, and the various types of yoga nidras that do take us into liminal state, each system we explore. So I will teach, for instance, the Richard Miller style, where we work with opposing patterns, which is very, very good for all of those layers. But I particularly like it for the mental sheath, the manamaya kosha. Mm-hmm. So you can, go back and forth. And it's great for templates of belief, too, that are stored in the vijnanamaya kosha, the intuitive place. It's that when we really want to open up to the buddhi, that part of mind that creates the, that is our Buddha, our inner teacher, that what's blocking that are templates of belief. Mm-hmm. So then we do this vichara and deeper inquiry to go through that. But the mental sheath is great for that, because you can look at where you store hatred in your body, and then where you store love or joy. And these going back and forth, giving sort of cues during a yoga nidra to work with these emotional triggers, and bringing those up to look at and seeing that they're energy. Okay, so that would be one way. And so also we work with the system of placing nyasa, 61 points of light, and then allowing people to just rest in awareness, and then sometimes moving off into deeper experiences. And then the very common type of that's used, which I really love, which is a rotation of consciousness, and then using visuals that are said very quickly to also trigger. It's very similar to Richard Miller's way of using opposing patterns to kind of bring up, bubble this energy up and look at it and allow it to dissolve. But that uses quick images. So they might be anything from a plate of cookies to the moon in water, reflected in water, to, you know, the earth seen from above, from space, you know, to a snake coiled 3.5 times, to a woman crying, to a man on a sofa with his dog, or, you know, anything that kind of brings up people's memories. And they're said quickly. And that is also wonderful practice. So yeah, going through those different types, we teach those and teach the background to them. But in regards to formal courses, my friend, Rod Stryker, I used to assist Rod. He's got his Power Yoga Nidra training as well. And that's a good introductory course. And goodness, as far as other Yoga Nidra trainings, I think Richard's, you know, his really quite fantastic. His IRIS program is still very, very good. Mm-hmm. And he's a scientist. So, you know, that would be another one that I'd recommend. And I think that for entry level, it's really excellent.
Yeah, we had the opportunity, this one a couple of years ago, to have Richard on. And he's really a treasure trove of wisdom,
amazing
knowledge on this sort of thing.
Yeah. Right.
So can you say just a little bit more? I mean, really intrigued about this rotation of consciousness thing. You seem to hint at a little bit. Again, we only have so much time to get into the weeds here, but just say a little bit about that, how that actually works as a method, technique in and of itself, what the actual mechanics of that might actually entail.
Okay, so you know, first of all, when we just do a straight body scan for people to connect with their body and relax the body, right? That's a classic quick thing that we can do. Feel your feet, feel your palm, feel the forehead, feel the third eye, feel inside your mouth, et cetera. So you can do sort of how Richard works with rotation of consciousness is he does it randomly. It'll never be the same. Hop from here, from there, move around and feel. But most of the Sri Vidya tradition works with a very precise pattern. It's always the same. So you would do this nyasa, and that would rotate the consciousness in those particular points, starting with the brow level, going to the throat, then to the right shoulder, elbow, wrist, right thumb tip, index finger, middle, you know, et cetera. And then go back up, precise order. Another that I feel is the most, and that's a fantastic, 61 points of light is, I practice it daily. You know, this is just a perfect way to relax the body and prepare it then doing my sleep and dream yoga practices, you know, my night yoga practices. And that's one that everybody can easily, once they have that pattern, it's an excellent way to prepare to go into practices, especially if they need to unwind or they need healing or, you know, so that's fantastic for that. But then the last that I love for getting people that are really tense is a rotation of consciousness that we just like to call, nickname the homunculus, but because it's kind of patterned off of that funny, funny thing that they used to think that we have,
right.
A little man inside the brain. Okay. So the homunculus way of doing things, I love, because it really gets people so deeply relaxed. In fact, most of them fall asleep. And so you have to keep, if you want them to stay liminal, you have to keep telling them, do not fall asleep, stay awake and aware, do not fall asleep, stay awake and aware. But that is also a precise pattern. And the rotation of a consciousness would then start in the hand and move up the arm and back down and then go to the leg. So you would do right side of the body, left side of the body, and then go up to the head and down and front and back. So you're covering the entire body in a particular pattern, and that's also easy to learn. And then you can do that on your own. And it has very deep, I'm not sure why. I've been trying to figure this out, but that particular pattern just allows us to go into the deepest rest. So I could do it for you if you like, but then you drop out and there would be no more.
Exactly.
you could tell us your dream. You'd be off flying.
Well, you know what we could definitely do, Michelle, is provide a link at the bottom, sure. where you have something like that, where people could actually be guided by you into the sort of thing. Because again, I'd love to do that. This stuff is so beautiful because it's a marvelous practice in and of itself, but it also provides, it's really one way, the first of the natural meditations, because it provides the off-ramp, so to speak, onto these. And so as we go deeper into it, we become a little bit more familiar with it. I would suspect with you, as with me, then the depths start to naturally reveal themselves. You realize, whoa, yeah. this is a really wonderful multi-layered practice. So maybe talk to us a little bit about how this may, you suggested something about this earlier, but how this unfolded for you in your own practice, and then ways for the listener to be invited to explore how this can eventually take you all the way to clear light yoga, to Ursal sleep yoga, as it's defined in the six yogas.
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, I think that the yoga nidra is, I wanted to talk a little bit and let people know that I also think it's just extraordinarily healing for the physical body. And one of the things that happened to me during my traumatic brain injury is, you know, of course, I couldn't sleep through the night, and I had the sympathetic nervous system was dominating. The cortisol was high, and you know, the pituitary was affected, so I wasn't producing the hormone to keep me asleep. And so we do yoga nidras to rest, and that was extraordinarily healing for my body. I don't think I would be where I'm at today, you know, just 3 years after that, because I had to learn how to read again and balance. Everything was taken out. So a lot of vestibular training and occupational therapy and speech therapy, and yoga nidra really accelerated the healing. But right before the pandemic, it was at the pandemic start, I was still quite bad and going, you know, 3 or 4 times a week for therapy and still having seizures. And the pandemic hit and I fell down the stairs. They weren't seeing me for therapy. So I fell down and I landed on my shoulder and my knees. My left shoulder and my knees, and one of my knees buckled back, and I thought, oh, I have a PCL injury for sure. The pain was extraordinary, and the left shoulder was also swollen like crazy. I couldn't lift my arm, move it in any direction. I thought, I've certainly torn my rotator cuff. Yeah. And I know enough, you know, as a yoga therapist and the working with what was happening. So I started calling. And I had my husband call, you know, the doctors to try to see if I could get anybody to give me an MRI, but the whole city was shut down. There was nobody that would take you. And I called, you know, orthopedic surgeons, my first orthopedic surgeon. I was calling everybody, all of the people that had been seeing me at the hospital. And nobody would take the call even. I'd leave messages. Nobody would call back. I called my neurologist, and he called back about 3 weeks later, maybe 3 or 4 weeks later, finally to make an appointment. But really, the pain was extraordinary. I had about a week of lying in bed in misery, you know, with ice and all of the different things I was trying to do to just get comfortable. And I could not sleep. And so I finally, one night, was doing yoga nidra, and I was asking, you know, Buddhas and protectors and all the deities and angels and everybody in within this yoga nidra. And I placed the 61 points of light. And then at one point, I realized that I was sleeping, and all this light was pouring in, and I was sleeping and light was moving into my body, and all of these 61 points were lit up, and it was like the stars above were connecting to the stars in the body, and there was just streams of light. And then I became lucid, and then I returned to sort of ordinary consciousness, waking consciousness. And I thought, I've been asleep. How wonderful, I was sleeping. And then I thought, wait, I don't have the pain like I did. And then I started to move my arm and move my leg, and it was completely well. And so then when the neurologist called me, I said, Dr. Chestnut, strangest, when he asked me, well, I hear you fell again, and this one is really bad, and I'm sorry we couldn't get to you, et cetera. And I said, the strangest thing happened. I think I had like this, all I could say to him was, it's like an angelic healing or something. And he said, that's all you can do right now. Yeah, and he said, good for you. And he just said, it's fantastic. It's good for you. So you know, I'm not supposed to make claims like this, right? I'd get in trouble with Yoga Alliance. But I do think if you can really relax and work with this practice, that the type of healing benefits, especially if you work with classically in Yoga Nidra, we use, as we do, you know, in Buddhism, we work with a high spiritually guided vow and intention, a sankalpa. And, you know, we, of course, the Bodhisattva vow is one of those. We state them three times, but we can also do this for the other things. You know, intentions can be based on healing. It can be based on whatever it is needed. So.
Well, I think you're sharing of it is really inspirational. Certainly is for me. Can you say, Michelle, or to what do you then attribute the healing? I mean, where do you think what gave rise to that type of resolution with your body? Where do you think that came from?
This is a really good question, Andrew. And I'll have to say that I think some things you just don't know, but I do, because anything I say, isn't it in a way, it doesn't give it justice, but I would say, you know, I do very much feel connected to Buddhas and protectors and the universal energy, the clear light energy. So it's there for us to draw upon. Okay, so it's there. Yeah. We have this infinite energy that everything is, and this is the infinite energy of immeasurable love, and it's the infinite energy. It's clear light energy. So we can draw upon it, and it can bring healing, and we just have to open ourselves up to it.
Yeah.
So this is why I think it's helpful sometimes with people that have come to do yoga nidra workshops with me, or just taken a yoga nidra at Menla. We do some usually at night, the last session, and they'll say, I've been meditating for 25 years, and I've never had a samadhi experience before. I'm very devoted to my practice, and I have a daily practice. But I had this happen, I had this experience. So here tonight. And I think it's because they really just finally let go.
Yeah.
And they're held in that container. Mm-hmm. And that's how it happens.
Yeah, I think I might just put forth a possible conjecture of what this could be. What I come onto this that I think is really, really beautiful, resonates more and more with what I'm talking about these days is, we tend in the West to have this default thing to the context being physical, material, and then kind of the spiritual thing is held within that or at best a sidebar. Yeah. But I think what I hear when I see this, hear this experience from you, Michelle, is that it points to the power of the heart mind.
Yeah.
It points to the foundational, I don't want to use the word supremacy because that's not the right word, but the extraordinary power of opening to that type of healing energy. And then in a very real way, because it actually is more foundational. It's right. Heart, mind, spirit, whatever, mind, consciousness doesn't arise from matter. I mean, it's completely backwards. And so when we touch into something that's actually more foundational than even matter itself, i.e. the body, then I think because it is so foundational, I would conjecture that that's where perhaps the healing comes from, because you're opening, touching into something upon which, again, with the koshas, this totally makes sense, right?
Right.
That is an expression of this more foundational basis. And so I think these types of stories are really important because they're inspirational for people. It's like, okay, my life is so busy. Why should I bother? I often playfully say when people work with the nocturnal meditations, that's where ego puts his big do not disturb sign up, right? You can rouse me from my psycho-spiritual slumber during the day, but do not touch me when I sleep, right? And so, if we have a deeper understanding of this power and your sharing of it, which is really very beautiful, then it certainly inspires me. It's like, okay, this is why it may be worth exploring something like this, developing some facility. Because when you're working with something so foundational, again, we started with you're working with the roots of your experience, then the other koshas, the body itself, then naturally kind of realign or heal because it's so foundational. And the clear light, everything comes from the clear light, is an expression of the clear light. So when you tap into it, whoa, look what happened. So to speak, miraculous, right?
Yes, yes. So, very much so. I think that's the thing too with this classic way. So 11th century scripture, Tripura Rihasya, talks about sankalpa.
Mm, yeah.
And it says that sankalpa, or this intention, this spiritually guided intention, which is based on the Purusha Arthas, right? The Purusha man's four desires or four potentials, and the first being dharma, to really know their dharma, and the second artha, to have the means to do that, and the third is kama, the pleasure, the art, and then last is moksha, liberation. Mm-hmm. Right? But so it speaks about the Purusha Arthas, and then that you set your sankalpa, your intention, based on one of those, whatever is needed at that time. So if you don't know why you're here, what your life purpose is, what your mission is, then that's the focus. But if you have that, maybe you don't have, you're an artist, but you don't have the means to focus on the art. So then you might make your sankalpa around the artha, the means to bring that in. Maybe you have all of that, but you need more, want connection, relationship, pleasure. All of those two middle ones are kind of controversial, of course. But then the last one, the moksha, the liberation, the freedom, or the enlightenment. And this one is, of course, where we're, you know, our territory, right, as Buddhist practitioners. But so this scripture then says that you have to, if you are going to have success with your sankalpa, you make one based on one of those. But then if you're going to have success with it, it needs to be free of any doubt, free from the stains of doubt. Absolutely free from, and it uses stains, you know. And this is a thing that I find, like, when you say going back down to the heart mind, you know, because so many of us really, we're practicing, but then we don't really believe that it's possible even to be liberated in one lifetime. But I really do, you know, and I've seen that it's, that if this yogini can have the changes and things happen from a place of great suffering and real trauma as a child, to now, you know, having a joyous life and helping others and, you know, being at peace and continue, and then having the great blessing of this human life and being exposed to, you know, the Buddhist teachings as well, and this noble eightfold path. Yeah. And, you know, it's just a treasure. So, you know, I really believe that we can, if we all use the mind, this great mind, if we can become really truly free of the obscurations, you know, and then be free of any doubt, that we can change things, that we can transform, that we can use this clear light energy, we could save our planet. We have the brilliant people here, you know. We don't have to see it all go down, you know. But so many people I know are really just really think it's impossible, and that. So I think that that's something I like to, I just say to you that what you sparked that for me by saying, coming back down to that essential and heart mind, and that there in that space, anything is possible.
Yeah.
But we also, and then we can start to realize that, yeah, I was completely surrendered then. I didn't have any other options, you know. So it wasn't just a point of like complete letting go into it. And I had a friend, a yoga student, very early on when I was teaching seriously and Hatha Yogi, and she practiced at the Shambhala Center. But she had pancreatic cancer, and it was stage 4, and they finally, she was a mom and had a couple twin children, 4 years old, and another daughter who was 7. And she asked her family if it would be okay if she went to Colorado and spent time with the Sakyong. And he was there, and do a month retreat with him. And she said goodbye to her family, thought she would die there because it was really, really bad. She didn't have very much time. And she had been through this for years and had gone in remission, and now it was back in a serious way. So she went and she let go and she said her goodbyes. When she came back, she didn't have any more cancer.
No way. Wow.
And people flipped around her. They thought she was, you know, they got scared of being in her presence.
Wow.
Because it was just so miraculous. But I think that part of letting go. So again, you know, back to Yoga Nidra, I think it's just a great all-around practice to help us relax,
yeah,
to help us let go, to help us get out of stress, to help to trust that the more we let go, the more we are supported. You know, even sometimes I think with my Vajrayana practice, there's so much ritual and things that I have to do, you know, and keep my samaya and everything. And so then I then going back into Yoga Nidra makes it a little easier then to pop in, you know. So
fantastic. I mean, it's really inspirational, not only the story of the woman who had the healing, but also where this has taken you and what it has accomplished and released you from in your own lifetime. I mean, it's really fantastic. I mean, really.
Well, we all have this. We're humans.
Isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's really interesting. We're often, one of the things I reflect here, Michelle, is, you know, there's so many different levels of fear that we all have. But I think on one level, we're afraid of our own power on one level. And therefore, that's where the doubt comes in. We actually doubt that we are Tara or Vajrayogini. So we have to fake it, which is great. That's what the practice is for. Yeah. We fake it. We fake being Kala Chakra. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
But we're of two minds, literally, doubt. And so the more I hear these sorts of things, the more it brings about this ziji, this confidence that within that, you know, again, tying it back in, essence of spiritual practice is remembrance. We are the Buddha. We are the deity. Yeah. And we forget. And so when we open, relax, 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 which is what this marvelous practice of Yoga Nidra does, and eventually, yes, on a provisional level, it relaxes the body in this conventional healing way. But more fundamentally, it'll allow you to relax into the nature of mind, reality itself, the clear light mind. Yeah. And then from there again, then we have these miraculous powers because we are those powers. And so the more we have this right view, right, that don't be afraid of your power. Don't be afraid to shine. You just have to release, get out of the way, let go. And this radiant healing light not only will cure you, but in this dark age will then radiate. I can see it in your very presence. Shines forth and then helps us in this Kali Yuga, you know, helps the world right now. So again, that's the other thing to always bear in mind. We're not just doing this for ourselves, right? We're doing it for the benefit of others and for this world that's in such need.
Most definitely. This is, and this is why, you know, Bob and I started to do this Vajra Yoga school, because one of the things that is so important to us is that this, altruistic intention, bodhicitta, this spirit of enlightenment, that we aren't just practicing for ourselves, and that we are great, powerful beings, and with our presence, you know, with the Buddha's breath, and just being in the presence you know, that we will have the tools to help others, and that we are these powerful beings, and we'll be able to make sure. So yeah, I think this goal vehicle, that was so extraordinary for me, because when I was practicing Trividya, before I even knew that it was just at the beginning of it, and I didn't have explanation yet about what was happening. I didn't understand deity yoga, and I was chanting the Lalita Sahasranama and disappeared. And when I came back, I realized, or I saw myself as not my ordinary self. Mm. I was something else. Then it was like a female presence, an energy, a goddess type of energy, something there. And then my Judeo-Christian upbringing came in and said, "Who the hell do you think you are?" Right. And at that point, it collapsed, and I was miserable. And then I had horrible fevers for a few days. Then I gave up that practice. I had no idea that was actually
supposed to happen.
Then later, you know, you go in and go to practice the goal vehicle, and you're there creating yourself as the deity. And only lucky if you ever come upon that. But you can, you know, you can do it if you keep, again, getting out of the way. So we're practicing being that, but then sometimes not knowing is helpful in this case of
I would
love to arise as Vajrayogini just like that spontaneously, but it's too much.
this little clip came to mind. I think it was W.C. Fields. I'm not sure. Again, I'll take wisdom wherever I can get it. Where he said, it's not what they call you, it's what you answer to.
And so
you know, they call you provisionally Michelle, and you answer to that. But no, you're really Tara, you're really Kala Chakra, right? And so
Yamantaka.
Exactly. Yeah, the Death Destroyer. So this is really the really beautiful technique of divine pride, that, and again, it is, and not a criticism to the Abrahamic traditions, and their interesting way of looking at original sin, that sort of thing. Well, these wisdom traditions talk about original purity, original divinity, original goodness, basic goodness. And so understanding this, we have to cut ourselves a little bit of slack in the Western world. I remember Trungpa Rinpoche said something very beautiful along these lines, where somebody was talking to him about his study of Buddhism when he was a young child in Tibet. And he said something really, really lovely. He said, you know, you have to realize how lucky I was. Here I am. I'm in a country and a culture that's so steeped in the Dharma. It's like everybody's living, breathing the Dharma. He said, for me, it was easy. And he didn't say it directly, so I'm putting words in his mouth, but he said, give yourself a little bit of a break. It's not that easy in the West, where we're brought up, you know, this enculturation of the Abrahamic traditions has had a massive insidious deleterious effect on our culture and this poverty mentality. And so therefore, when we hear these things, I mean, what you said, like, who do you think you are? That's fantastic, yeah. Right? Yeah. Well, you remember, you know, I am whatever the deity. So the practice of divine pride, and then guess what? When you settle into reality, then that in itself is curative, right? From that, then you get these so-called miraculous cures because you're in resonance with what's really happening. So, Michelle, this is
what's really happening. Yeah,
this is great,
Andrew.
So as we start to close up, tell us a little bit. You mentioned just a few things about this amazing program that you and Professor Thurman are doing. And people who are listening know how much I adore him. I mean, this is an amazing individual. So you and Bob are engaged in this remarkable yoga curriculum. Talk to us a little bit about that and how people can learn about it. The Vajra Yoga program will obviously attach links and stuff to that. But people really need to know about what you and Bob are doing here. It's remarkable.
Yeah. So Bob Thurman, you know, he's my teacher, and I started to teach something called Buddha and the Yogis with him, and that was he had started that with my teacher of Hatha Yoga, Richard Freeman and John Campbell, and they were looking at, you know, where Buddhism and Hatha Yoga met, and sharing ideas about it. And so then I came in, he asked me to come in and fill John's place. And then we loved working together and we loved debating about things and like Turiya and clear light, right? and then he said, will you do a school for me? And it started out to just be a 300-hour Yoga Alliance teacher training, which he had always wanted to have the yogis there at Menla. But then he had a dream after we started doing that. He had this dream that out of the windows of Tibet House US in New York City, there were all these yogis hanging out, and just, it was so many yogis crammed in the room that they were, you know, flowing into the streets, and Tibet House was filled with yogis. And he said, I think that we need to do, you know, expand this and take Vajra Yoga around the world and help His Holiness with his fourth aim. That, you know, being to bring back Vajrayana that was removed from India, in a sense, with the invasion of, you know, the Islamic. Yeah. So he ended up, you know, asking me to do this school, which we have now started a 300-hour training, but now it's really taking off and people want us to do more programs, including we would like to have Andrew Holacek and his team head up the sleep and dream division.
The sleep right? department.
The sleep department. Anyway, so, you know, Vajra Yoga the intention is to bring in the teachings of the Buddha and Vajrayana into the already established around the world popular yoga studios, right? And not to diminish Vajrayana, but to actually educate and have it be an entryway level for just people everywhere, you know, to experience these teachings. And, you know, we believe in this kind of complex, globalized world that asks for a democratic access to what that His Holiness the Dalai Lama calls open-heartedness, right? That this equates to a development of enlightenment through the three practices available to everyone, which is the mutual tolerance, transcendence of ideological and institutional conventions, and then just raising general kindness and empathy and compassion amongst all different kinds of people. And so, giving people this opportunity to develop that, to cultivate those things, and also bring in sort of the three principles of the path into the yoga center. And ethics being a big part of Vajrayoga as well, because from seeing both on and in all of the traditions, so having ethical training for yoga teachers, and that is one of our big intentions as well. Also introducing people to bardo and how the yogi and the householders can understand the dying process, right? And so it's been successful because there are so many people out there that are practicing Hatha Yoga already and that are also practicing Buddhism. And they are yoga teachers that are wanting to figure out, how do I bring these two together?
Nice.
And how do I share with the general public these teachings? And so it's become a way for people to share with teachers how to do that and bring to them the Lanrim in sort of a 9-month training program, and that can then be expanded on to 4-year training and ongoing. So we're starting with just a 300-hour training, but it's moving to, we hope, a 4-year curriculum.
Oh wow!
As well, so
that's amazing. I mean, how inspirational is that?
Yeah.
Well, definitely. Just, yeah. No, go ahead. I'm sorry, Dave.
Yeah, it's kind of up-leveling, it's up-leveling the current way that yoga has taught in yoga studios to bring up the whole psychological and well-being
in a wonderful kind of cross-pollination between these traditions, right? They have so much to offer.
That's right.
In a tantric way, you bringing and working with both body and mind in a really skillful way. It's fantastic. And I can't imagine anybody better than you to do that.
I don't know about that.
Trust me, I know about it. I see you as the deity, right? I have.
Well, that's it. That's it.
Pure perception.
That's it, Andrew. That's the only way it's possible.
Seriously.
And I see you as now, which deity you're seeing me right now is, I don't want to ask. This last year, 2020, was a very interesting year because my father died in October.
Sorry.
And it was a day after I had audience with His Holiness. I was actually flying back. And I also saw Ling Rinpoche, who was the first to give me White Tara 4 years before, and who had blessed my mala back then, and I had thought of every day. Mm. And for some reason, I had not used that white mala since, that time. But then in the beginning of 2020, I had the opportunity to have the Abhishekam for Yamantaka, and then started studying it. And then Bob gave me teachings, and many wonderful things happened. And I did my Leirung, and I had my fire puja on the Scorpio eclipse that happened. It was the lunar eclipse. Bob and I did a puja in his backyard in May of 2022. My father died on the Scorpio solar eclipse that happened 6 months later. Oh. Now, the amazing thing about this is that I started to see myself, even though, you know, Chakrasamvara and Kalachakra and Vajrayogini, those were my main practices. But then this year, Yamantaka became my, you know, my practice. And I would walk around seeing myself with all those legs and my giant phallus and, and going down the street as this. And, but the interesting thing is that when I, the day that I was doing the fire puja, I picked up the white mala and that Ling Rinpoche had blessed. And I started to use that from then on. And I, Bob said, oh, well, you know that the reason is because he is the one that is that lineage holder for Yamantaka. And I had a very special connection with him already. I knew that I did. So then in Dharamsala, I saw him four different times randomly. The last time, an hour before I was going to leave in the forest. And I was on a walk going up before I had to get on this long plane. And he ran into me walking down the forest path the other way. And he said, again? And I said, he said, when are you leaving? You know, there was, it was just like he had seen an apparition or something. So then I find out that 2 days later that my father has passed away. And the amazing thing, the culmination of the story is that I was able to then WhatsApp to his attendant, and they did the bardo for my father. And so that whole year of doing the father tantra, learning my first father tantra, and it being Yamantaka, the Buddha that liberates us from death, and then having this special empowerment by the one that holds the lineage was quite something. And I have to say, pure magic.
Exactly.
So I believe in it. And I see you as that too.
Oh, Michelle, thank you. I mean, these stories are just, they're fantastic. Thank you so much for your courage and generosity and sharing them. Really, it's just fantastic. And so—
Thank you, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's such a delight.
I'm a little wacky today, but—
No, I want to introduce you to our community. You know, many people have been hearing about you, and I've had the great pleasure to get to know you a little bit, and even more so after our conversation together. So deep bow gratitude for your time with us, for everything that you're doing. The Vajra Yoga program is just off the charts. And with you and Bob at the helm, oh my gosh, I mean, you're like, you know, the sky's the limit, so to speak.
It's fun. Yeah. I will send you some yoga nidras for your
That'd be great.
Community. And a few different types for them to try, so they'll understand what I was trying to communicate.
Perfect. Yeah, just like with any practice, it's really only when you engage in it and do it, then it starts to click for you. You know, it's sometimes difficult to describe these things. So if they have the opportunity to actually explore it on their own, they'll see what the magic behind this practice
is. Oh, that's where it is. Then you'll understand.
That's where it comes from.
Perfect.
So Michelle, really big bow of gratitude. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Andrew.
Until next time.
I hope I'll see you soon. Maybe at the Tibet House US Gala.
Either there or Menlo again this summer. So all the best to you, and look forward to the next conversation.
Bye-bye. Okay.
Well, that's it for today. Thanks for joining us. And a big thanks to Michelle Low for taking time to share her amazing stories. If you enjoyed this nightclub offering, please check out everything else that's happening on this platform. Until next time, pleasant dreams.